Last several meetings have been a review of the development of Buddhism. From the time of the Buddha, the development of the various schools and traditions of Buddhism. Tonight's talk is focused on Buddhism and colonialism, how the intrusion of the imperial powers in the 18th and 19th century and 20th century affected Buddhism. And then the next talk is going to be focused on how Buddhism has affected the West, which also goes all the way back to time of the Buddha. But we'll be focused primarily on the 20th century up until these days. The intention with these talks is not to be kind of an in-depth scholastic review. What I'm trying to do with this is to convey a sense of Buddhism as a way that people lived in the times that they were on the planet and during their lives relative to Buddhism, and how their lived experience affected what we call Buddhism today, which until the colonial powers came into the East, wasn't called Buddhism at all. It was called Dhamma Vinaya, at least in the Theravada tradition. Dhamma meaning the truth or the way things really are, and Vinaya meaning the community, the organizational structure of how Dhamma was taught and how it spread, how people lived their lives. And the end goal for this review is to talk about how we are being effective, how Buddhism is affecting us, and how we are affecting Buddhism. When I say we, I mean in my lifetime. I started practicing Buddhism in 1982, and been a lot of changes in how Buddhism is portrayed and developed here in the West. So that's where we're headed with this. And once again, my purpose for this is to try to demythologize what we call Buddhism and make it more relatable, understandable, and hopefully applicable for us as we live through these times. The time of the Buddha was a time of radical change in that part of the world. I talked about that in the early talk a few weeks ago, actually the first talk. But the rate of change was incredibly slower then. As I've been saying repeatedly during these discussions, the time we live in now is probably the time of the most radical change in human culture, human lifespan, in all of human history. Remarkable times. And I personally think that Buddhism provides us with a really excellent resource for finding our way through this, and maybe even becoming more able to fulfill our potential as humans in this culture, in these times. So the intrusion of cultures, other cultures, into India and the East didn't start just with what we regard as the European colonial and imperial intrusions. Islam made a significant incursion into at least West India and what we now call Mongolia, and even into what we now call Indochina. And when I have read about Islam in the past, it seemed like this very warlike invasion of those areas. And there was some of that, but there was a lot of warfare going on all around the world, or at least that part of the world in those days. So, Brian, my co-host, I want to ask you, what's the last thing you heard me say?
I believe imperial.
Okay, did I talk about Islam? Did you hear me talk about Islam?
The sound is choppy.
Did you hear me talk
Still breaking up.
Did you hear me talk about Islam?
About what?
Did you hear me talk about Islam? Can't hear me still?
Yes, I think I did.
Yes.
But it's been...
really choppy?
You've just been chopped up and chattering, you know.
Yeah. Well, as I said...
it kind of comes and goes, comes back and goes.
Yeah, as I said before I started talking about tonight's topic, this is all being recorded separately from the computer. So when I post it, what I've been saying will be more clear. But let me just try to quickly say that Islam also had an impact on the development of Buddhism, but it wasn't anywhere near as impactful as was the case with the Europeans. So, 16th and 17th century, European explorers found a way to get to India and the Far East, sailing around the tip of Africa. So they were not confined to the Silk Road, which was an extensive series, kind of a web of trading routes that traveled through Muslim territory for the most part. And it was just a sort of a trickle. And the Islamic sultans exacted a very high tax on trade. So when they started to sail around the southern tip of Africa, started making contact, Portuguese, Dutch, French, and English traders and the vessels that were armed that accompanied them. So what I'm going to do is talk about the major traditions and how they were impacted, with a special emphasis on the Theravada tradition. I talked in the last week about how Theravada Buddhism was transmitted to Sri Lanka, the island off the southern tip of India. And during the second century before the Common Era, one of the sons and one of the daughters of Ashoka, who was arguably the first emperor of a truly united India. And this established Sri Lanka as the kind of the primary source of Buddhist teachings. The other source was the Mahayana, and they traveled north of the Himalayan mountains into China. But in Sri Lanka, in the about the 5th century of the Common Era, which would be like 700 years after the time of the Buddha, a monk named Buddhaghosa traveled to Sri Lanka after hearing reports of the Sri Lankans starting to write down the teachings on banana leaves, which became eventually known as the Tripitaka, the three baskets, the suttas, the Vinaya, and the Abhidhamma. So he came down there and spent his whole career compiling what we call today the Visuddhimagga, which is translated as the Path of Purification, which is a very, very thick book. I have a copy, and I've read a good bit of it, but it's a difficult read. And so this is really the primary resource for Theravada Buddhism, and has been since that time. And contemporary research, even though the Visuddhimagga is supposedly the direct teaching of the Buddha, contemporary research suggests strongly that what is in the Visuddhimagga was not really what was going on at the time of the Buddha and for a century or so afterwards. It was significantly impacted by the development of the various Hindu schools that were also flourishing and interacting with Buddhism during that period of time. And so this was sort of the touch point for the Europeans when they started to come into that part of the world. So the first there were the Portuguese in the 16th century. And they brought Catholic missionaries with them. They were also, at the same time as there being Buddhists there, they were also Muslims and Tamil Hindu sects. And I realize that my voice is breaking up, but do the best I can with what we got here tonight. The Catholic Portuguese put a lot of pressure on the population to convert to Catholicism. And the residents, the indigenous people of Sri Lanka, did not like that. So there was a lot of conflict, a lot of rebellions and so forth. So about 100 years later, 17th century, the Dutch started to come into Sri Lanka. And they made a deal with the indigenous Sri Lankan leadership that they would chase out the Portuguese if they would get a trade monopoly. And sure enough, they did. Took over the entire island. And whatever Catholic presence was there, they were they were expected to convert to. I just mentioned that the Dutch came into Sri Lanka in the 1600s, 17th century, and made a deal with the Sri Lankans to get rid of the Portuguese, which they did. But they really colonized the island. They made the Catholics convert to Protestant religion, but they were more liberal with the Buddhist, Muslim, and Tamil Hindu population. They could continue their practices. Well, you can imagine what it was like for those people in those times to be subjected to these foreigners who were coming in with vastly superior weaponry and really were dominating the countryside. So in the 19th century, early in the 19th century, early 1800s, the British took over the island from the Dutch, and they renamed it Ceylon. And this had the most significant impact on Buddhism and that part of the world. They pretty much disenfranchised the population and divided the land up into estates, which is what they had done in the previous century in Great Britain, in the island, and in Ireland. The nobility basically carved up the countryside and thrust the population into serfdom. And in Ceylon, it created these huge tea plantations and took wood from the island and so forth and so on. So there was a lot of conflict. This control of the British lasted from the early 19th century into the after World War II, in the 20th century. And once the colonial powers left, the name Sri Lanka was reclaimed. Now, the way that the population in these areas was impacted as it moved around the southeast part of that, what we now call Indochina, and was the Kingdom of Siam, which is now what we call Thailand, but also parts of it were Burma. And the British had also, because they had conquered India, India was part of the British Empire, and Buddhism had pretty much been eradicated in India, there started to be conflict with Burma and Thailand. So in the 19th century, a Thai Buddhist monk named Vajrayan, who was one of the sons of that the king, became the King of Siam. Now, he became developed mastery in the Abhidhamma, which is the Buddhist psychology. And after he had done that for about 20 years, he realized that he really needed to learn how to meditate more effectively. So he left where he was a leader in Siam and when he became king, he pretty much reestablished a disciplined Sangha and the Vinaya Code. Now, his name was, as a king, was Mongkut, and he is actually the model for the book Anna and the King of Siam, from which the musical The King and I was created. So we have this image of Yul Brynner dancing around with, I forget who the actress was, maybe Julie Andrews. That actual king was a monk, and he was a great reformer of colonial Burma. And there was a lot of conflict going on between the indigenous people of Indochina and the British and the French. The French were dominant in Vietnam, but the British were pretty much dominant in Siam and in Burma. So the influence, the importance there that I want to convey, and I hope that you all can hear this, is that during this time, the late 19th century, there were certain monks who were inspired by King Mongkut, And the one that was most impactful, relevantly, in a way that's relevant to how we are practicing now, was a teacher named Ledi Sayadaw. Ledi was the name of the forest he lived and taught in. Sayadaw is an honorific, acknowledging a teacher. And he also had been a master of Abhidhamma and then decided he was really going to practice meditation intensively. And the intrusion of British colonialism brought with it more of that missionary Christianity, and it was a significant threat to the national commitment to Buddhism. So he started traveling around Burma and Siam, teaching anyone who was willing to learn, whether they were renunciates or just lay practitioners, how to practice Vipassana. Now, Vipassana had pretty much fallen by the wayside. Most of the Buddhist monks were scholars and had certain kinds of leadership positions. I mentioned King Mongkut as one of them. But he decided to really emphasize meditation practice. So there were a couple of teachers who he had a strong influence on. One of them was a person called Mahasi Sayadaw. And he was the leader of an area of Burma called the Mahasi. And Mahasi Sayadaw was a direct influence on people who founded the Insight Meditation Society in the 1970s in Massachusetts, in the U.S. Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Larry Rosenberg, and others were strongly influenced by that particular meditation technique, which I will be talking about more in depth in a future talk. It also was a strong influence through on another person, a lay practitioner named Ubakin. Now, Ubakin was an interesting person. He was an accountant, but he had learned a particular kind of meditation practice, which they called Vedanupassana. We call it body sweep, which I talk about a lot. I practice on a daily basis. And he mastered this practice. But when Burma was liberated from the British, from colonialism, he actually became the treasurer of the newly formed Burmese government. And they picked him because he was absolutely honest, was not the least bit corrupt. And so they relied on him to create a very rational way to manage the finances and other parts of the Burmese, the new Burmese government. So Ubakin trained a person named S.N. Goenka, and I had personally been on several Goenka-led retreats many years ago. And interestingly enough, another one of his students who he authorized to teach this meditation practice to was woman named Ruth Dennison, who was an interesting person of her own, in her own way. But Ruth Dennison was the teacher of my very first retreat in 1982 at the Insight Meditation Society. So my first retreat, I was influenced by the teachings of Mahasi Sayadaw and teachings of Ubakin. So, for those of you who might want to understand more about this thread of influence on contemporary Buddhism, I attached the URL for an article by Lion's Roar magazine. The title of the article is The Insight Revolution, and it's about Ledi Sayadaw. So I have the URL in the notes that will be posted, and you can actually check out the article yourself. Now, I want to talk about the Mahayana schools, traditions. I talked about them last week, just to say that the Mahayana basically would involve Chan Buddhism, which was and still is dominant in China, and Shan Buddhism, which is dominant in Korea, and Zen Buddhism, which is dominant in Japan and to some extent in Vietnam. And what I want to do now is talk briefly about the Mahayana schools. Chan was probably the most impacted by the European intrusion, European colonialism. The British, French, and Russian commercial and imperial interests were moving into that area. The first missionaries were Jesuits in the 16th century. But then the British came in the 18th and 19th centuries and created a lot of conflict. There were several wars. In fact, the British made a lot of money getting opium that was grown in the area of what we now call Afghanistan and shipping it to China and selling it to hundreds of thousands of Chinese and creating an epidemic of opiate addiction. They had two wars over that, two opium wars, both of which were won by the British, but had a significant impact on the populace there. And to a large extent, Chan Buddhism, because it was very disruptive. The British influence was very disruptive on the combination of Chan and Confucianism that was dominant in China. So there was that influence. Now, Zen was relatively unaffected by Christian missionaries. The Japanese were very, very leery of Europeans. And for a long time, during the Shogun period, they would not allow Europeans into Japan. They would allow them to create ports. I think Nagasaki was their home base for trade, but they were not particularly involved, did not allow the British to be involved in any way in the everyday affairs of Japan. But part of what was going on with Japan during that time was the militarization of Zen Buddhism. And of course, the ultimate outcome of that was how the Zen tradition was really corrupted by the militarists of the 1930s and 1940s that invaded China and invaded the Pacific, World War II. In Tibet, Tibetan culture was pretty much isolated because of its geographic position up in the eastern ranges of the Himalaya Mountains. It was not very affected by European intrusion. So there were various Mongolian and Chinese invasions, imperial invasions over the centuries, but that did not have the kind of impact that we're focused in on this particular talk. So the talk tonight is not very long, which is, I guess, in a sense, somewhat fortunate because the signal is really lousy here on this end and for you all. But I do want to provide some opportunity for discussion if you have any questions about how the West intruded into Buddhist cultures in that part of the world. Any questions or comments about that? So considering that really lousy streaming connection tonight, I guess we're going to have a very short
Peter,
meeting.
This is Sandra.
Okay, Sandra, yes? Sandra? Hello?
No, Alex. Hey.
Yeah?
I was going to make a comment, but it seems the signal is so choppy, a conversation might be extra hard tonight, so I think I may pass.
Well, hold on a second. Hey, Peter, would you try maybe, I have a suggestion, maybe could you kill your video? That might help a little bit. Because it'd be less you having to transmit, if that makes sense.
I'm trying to cut off the video, but when I go there, I know how to do that. Okay, is that making a difference? Is the signal better now?
Sounds better.
Well, the sound seems a little more smooth.
Okay, well, that's good to know. So, Sandra, you had a comment, question?
Well, I was going to comment and say it seems that the West intruded, as you know, you know, we took what we wanted or what we felt was relevant and brought it back, and now, you know, we're really in modern times we're taking what we like out of it and making it our own.
That's the nature of imperialism. And one of the things that we have to be careful about in our own understanding of how Buddhism is coming to us, that we are not distorting Buddhism in ways that are deleterious in terms of our own benefit. You know, that's one of the problems with yoga, particularly Hatha yoga, as it's come into this culture. It's been very much commercialized. And the same is concern is being talked about a lot in terms of how Vipassana might be commercialized and be a process for training people to be more effective worker bees, which would be, you know, sad. But it's going on. I know that there are some people who are really promoting mindfulness as a way to improve the performance of mid and upper level executives in large Fortune 500 corporations. Not that that wouldn't be beneficial, but in terms of the basic tenets of Buddhism. But if you leave out the ethical considerations, then that's a real problem. If you make it too commercial, that's a real problem. You know, I started out my training in meditation with transcendental meditation back in the early 1970s. And I was not impressed with the commercialization of their meditation training. They charged a bunch of money for it. And I was a poor hippie artist at the time, and the only reason I learned TM was because a teacher basically took into consideration my impoverishment. And that's how I learned transcendental meditation. Very low fee. But the same thing could be happening with Theravada Buddhism or Mahayana Buddhism for that matter. You know, Zen or Tibetan Buddhism. Other questions or comments about how Buddhism was impacted? A lot of what was going on is the Buddhist world kind of retracted and became more insular and defensive in terms of the onset of Westerners, into those cultures, and still has some apprehension about that, and I think rightly so. Any other questions or comments? All right, so let's have an abbreviated meeting tonight because of these technical difficulties.
Can you hear me?
Yes, John, I can hear you.
I don't think that will make any difference with the audio on my end. It's still just as screwed up with your picture. I prefer seeing you than to the wheel, but I don't know if anybody else does. But I had a comment on the earlier meditation. You know how you said let go? Well, it seems to me, for me, I don't have two functions. I just go back to breath. I don't let go. But I guess that's what you're saying, is letting go is going back to breath. I never, you know what I mean? I'm hearing it's two functions, but I just go back to breath. You know what I mean? So that's kind of my...
That's letting go.
And it isn't...
There's a function. There's a function of practice in mindfulness meditation that is renunciation. And renunciation basically is identifying the experience of craving and clinging and disregarding it. And the primary tool for doing that is breath awareness. So breath awareness stabilizes attention and quiets the mind. And along with that is the training injunction that whenever the mind wanders from the breath, you bring attention back to the breath, which is renunciation at that point. And really what's going on with renunciation is it's strengthening the executive function of the brain, part of the brain that's called the preorbital cortex, the forehead. Those neurons interrupt essentially what we would call craving and clinging. They get stronger and stronger, and they tend to moderate the activity of the parts of the brain that are involved with craving and clinging. So going back to the breath is the way we establish relinquishing. However, I mentioned this, I don't know if you all heard it or not. I don't know if you all heard it or not during the meditation, but I was saying that when you become adept at the letting go becomes an integral part of your practice. So it seems like every moment of subjective experience involves a process of letting go. It's an ongoing, persistent release. And that's part of what produces the altered states of mind that we call PT. Heightened enthusiasm and the fluidity of awareness when the mind is really quiet. And so relinquishment is a core part of the practice, and it becomes more and more accessible and more potent over time. But every time we go back to the breath, that's what we're doing. So I don't know if that's helpful for you or not, John, or if you can even hear me.
So you're equating the sound is terrible. You're equating the renunciation with letting go. I was just thinking, for me, it's sort of, you know what I mean? But I get it. I get it what you're saying.
Yeah. I think that we need to end tonight's meeting because it just seems to be getting worse and worse, the streaming connection. So let's sit for a moment. Wish you well, folks. I hope that we all remain healthy and reasonably happy until the next time we have a chance to chat. And I hope that our connection is more stable as well. So, good night. Take care.